in intelligent design. And it's the first time there's been a big documentary about this in America, strangely enough, though there was one in Britain, in the Horizon program, a year ago. Okay. And the contents of the thing are, you know, because the trial basically sort of kind of reenacts the trial, looks at the issues and so forth. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail about the nature of the trial. I might make reference to it later on. But the interesting thing about it is it was very controversial. And because in America there is there's a lot of kind of strong feelings about the sorts of things that ought to be taught in the classroom, in the science classroom. And America and Britain actually are very similar demographically with regard to this issue, but as it were, the political temperature is very different. So in both Britain and America, about 40% of people believe that some form of intelligent design, that's to say that it is unlikely that all of the diversity of life that we have was brought about just through random mutation and natural selection, which is Darwin's theory, basically. That is unlikely to be the entire story, that there's likely to be some kind of intelligence behind this. Okay, that's the intelligent design idea. About 40% of people, both in this country and in America, believe that and would like to see that taught in schools. The difference is, in the United States, you have a constitutional separation of church and state, because the people who promote intelligent design, for the most part, are religiously motivated. And in the United States, because of the way the Constitution was established, the state, which is the, you know, and so the state in this case is to be understood in terms of state schools, cannot be seen as promoting any kind of religious beliefs. Okay. And what this has meant in terms of the way the law has been interpreted, it has meant that religion has to be removed completely. So not only is it insufficient that you shouldn't be promoting religion, but you shouldn't even be mentioning it, right? And that anything that seems to be religiously motivated gets removed from the classroom. And that's the general, that's the way it's been for the last 20 years in terms of legal interpretations of the Constitution in the United States. Now, as you know, in this country, we have an established church. We don't have separation of church and state from a formal standpoint. We have the Church of England, right? And the beliefs are the same, and there has now begun a kind of discussion about evolution and intelligent design in this country, which is taking place. It doesn't have anything of the sort of political hot-button aspect that it does in the United States. It's one of the reasons why it's taken so long for a documentary to be made in America, is because various people who are part of this refuse to cooperate except before getting legal advice on the matter. And indeed, this is part of the story of me in this. At the last minute, I was pulled off the program. So nothing happened. This is the story. And it was largely because lawyers were very concerned about what might be said on the program. Because see, when you go on a national television program, this is true in this country as well, one of the first things that happens, you know, it's not just they call you up and you agree to do it and then you get there on the appointed day. It's not just that, right? They do a pre-interview of you, right? So you got some researcher. And they ask you a question, well, what are you likely to say to this, to that, the other thing? And I was shown this documentary in advance, so I have an advanced copy of it, so I'm watching. I've already seen it. And so I said some things about why I thought there has been no challenge. The ruling, by the way, if you don't know this, is that basically intelligent design lost, and since that time there hasn't been any other challenges to Darwin's theory of evolution in the court system in the United States. So in this respect, the case in 2005 was a kind of landmark case, right? So there's been no other challenges. And so I was asked about, and I was a person who's, as it were, representing the losing side of this case on the television program. There'd be an expert witness representing the other side. And I was asked my opinion about why I thought there has been no other challenges since then. And my answer was, I didn't think it had anything to do with the merits of the judge's decision, which I thought were pretty lame, but I thought it had to do with the legal costs. Okay, that is to say that the winning side, see, in constitutional cases in the United States, the loser has to pay all the legal fees. And so the plaintiffs, which were the American Civil Liberties Union, charged enormous legal fees, $1 million, brought loads of experts, they were always present at the trial. And so basically the school board that had raised this case got bankrupted. And all the people who were on there got booted out of office because they bankrupted the school board. And so that was like a warning signal sent, you might say, that if another case like this ever arises in the future, the American Civil Liberties Union is going to be there and it's going to charge through the nose. And if you lose the case, you've got to pick up the legal fees. And that was what I was going to say on national television, you see. So it was, and as it turned out, I don't know how this happened, but it turns out that this guy, some lawyers, quote-unquote, got involved and stopped the whole segment from showing. Now, I've written a letter to the New York Times about this. We'll see if it appears. I'll be able to judge this by Sunday, whether it's appeared. But, you know, in a sense, this gives you a sense of the kind of complexity of the issue here. Because, you know, obviously this is an issue about what sorts of things ought to be taught in science, and so there's a kind of a very straightforward intellectual issue that one may debate. But then there's the issue of the social context in which this intellectual debate occurs, which, as it were, has rules of its own. You see, and if you're a public intellectual, you've got to be managing both of these things at once. And, of course, you're not the only one managing it, right? I mean, the people who are providing the forums for public intellectual debate to take place, right, include people like the media and lawyers and all kinds of other characters, right? And you know, the media's thinking, wow, this is the kind of thing that actually will attract viewers because it's kind of controversial and sexy and so forth, right? But then lawyers get involved thinking, well, my God, this can potentially kind of undermine the credibility of what was decided in the case. Okay. As it turns out, there's a bill pending in the United States Congress to actually put upper limits on these legal fees that are charged in these constitutionally based cases. So then the influencing the larger political culture is also stake. Because this is a kind of program where whatever, 20, 25 million people watch every morning in the United States. Okay? It was going to be a 5-minute segment. And so they pulled it off. And so I was sent back home yesterday, well, on Monday evening actually. Version, you know, and that was the end of that. This is the sort of thing, this is what public intellectual life is about, where there's a sense in which it's not such a straightforward thing about telling truth to power, because it's not just enough to know what you think is right, and it's not enough to be willing to open yourself to criticism and scrutiny from others who may disagree with you, because I was quite prepared that this kind of view I hold would be challenged. But you also have to, you know, deal with these kinds of background issues, the forums in which these kinds of things happen. The one reason why I bring this example up is it's times like this where you should appreciate the value of a university, where we can actually talk about this without somebody coming in and pulling me out. Right? That's a very interesting point, right? There's a sense in which this space is sufficiently secure for public intellectual discussion that we can kind of raise this issue here, and I don't have to worry about, you know, the thought police coming in and pulling the plug. Right? And this is a point I think we often very much take for granted. Not only students take this for granted, but I think academics do as well, in the sense that it's one of the reasons, you know, academics in a way have a very valuable opportunity to raise controversial issues in a space where they cannot very easily be raised. And to talk about them at some length, not just for 5 minutes even. Okay? So when you think about what the value is of, you know, going to a university besides just, you know, getting degree certification in something that gets you a job, right, think about just the kind of nature of this space that we inhabit and what kinds of things are allowed here that wouldn't be allowed so easily elsewhere. And this gets close to the issue of academic freedom. Okay, and academic freedom is, in a way, where the academics, professional academics, interface with public intellectual life in the most direct way possible. Because, of course, when we talk about issues of academic freedom, we're not talking primarily about the kinds of things that you're likely to write in peer-reviewed technical journal articles to your other colleagues, right? Because basically, if the conclusions you draw on the basis of the research you do is sufficiently sound, then you'll get published. But then only three people will read it, too. The three people who can understand what the hell you were talking about. Right? So issues of academic freedom don't arise in that context, which are very restricted and to a certain extent self-censoring, in the sense that the only people who can really understand and participate in the discussions that you're raising in the peer review articles are people who have an enormous amount of formal training and are, as a result, able to talk in this, you know, convoluted jargon that we use as academics when we're writing professionally. Okay, so that's a very restricted kind of area. Academic freedom becomes an interesting issue when academics start talking about stuff that's publicly relevant in publicly accessible terms. Now, sometimes that happens in the classroom, of course. Right, and academic, and of course academics can do this also in through the media. And in this country now, there is a group called Academics for Academic Freedom, AFAF. You can sort of Google it. It was established earlier this year, largely because there were a lot of cases, or seemed to be a lot of cases in this country, actually having nothing to do with, well, actually one case did have to do with this issue of intelligent design, but for the most part having to do with people raising issues having to do with the racial component of intelligence and other kinds of socially desirable traits. And student unions basically condemning them. Okay, and trying to get faculty sacked and so forth. And there was one case, in fact, one of the most interesting cases occurred in Oxford, where the student union, being Oxford, a very clever student union, basically said that the removal of a particular faculty member was necessary in order to have a serious discussion. Because the faculty member in question, who actually raised the topic, and this was the topic of whether more migrants should be allowed into the UK, and this person's a professor of demography, right, so population, he was arguing that in fact it would, that if you kind of are open-ended with regard to migration policies, as the current, actually both parties tend to be, that what will happen is that in the long term this will put such a burden on the National Health Service, because people from different ethnic backgrounds genetically tend to be linked to different diseases and have different medical conditions, which means you have to have a wider provision of medical care to be ready to deal with all these issues, right, that this will put an unnecessary tax burden and it will make it impossible to run the National Health Service. And that ultimately the health service will become entirely privatized. Okay. So the whole argument about the economic value of having migrants in the country gets offset by the fact that the state welfare system isn't going to be able to absorb this. And that eventually this will put a greater financial burden on individuals who will then have to pay for their health care like they do in the United States. Okay, this is the argument that was being made by a professor of demography by the name of Coleman in Oxford. And this was considered racist and inflammatory, and so a student union at Oxford called for this guy to be sacked, okay, in order to have serious discussion. That's the great part, you see? That this man, because he holds an extreme view, was an obstacle to serious discussion, and that the only place, the only ideological perspectives, you know, between which you can have a serious discussion are in the middle. Right? Only the middle can discuss things with each other. The stuff on the extreme can't be allowed. And actually this argument, you know, the kind of more normal way in which this argument gets raised is in terms of people preventing the British National Party from speaking on campuses. Because the British National Party, if you go to their campaign manifesto 2005, you will see that they say exactly what I've just attributed to Professor Coleman. British National Party has, you know, and you know the British National, BNP, right? You're familiar with this. It's kind of the homegrown fascist party of Britain. And this party has really smartened up its act since its leader went to Cambridge. Its leader is a Cambridge graduate. And so you look on their website and you see all these very sophisticated quasi-evolutionary arguments that end up with this kind of conclusion that you have to restrict migration. In fact, the BNP goes one further. They say the British people should subsidize the repatriation of ethnic minorities who have not been in this country for, you know, X number of generations. Okay, so now the thing is that you get student unions saying, well, we can't have the British National Party on the campus because they're too extreme. We want to discuss the issues, but we don't want any extreme proponents of them. Now, this is very weird. Okay, but nevertheless, that's kind of, it's in this kind of climate, right, that this Academics for Academic Freedom was formed, and the whole point of the idea was to kind of remind people, you know, what exactly academic space is for and what it is, you know, when you're an academic, what is your public intellectual role? And the thing that needs to be protected here is the ability to use reason and evidence to argue for positions. And the content of the position, that is to say, the conclusion that you reach, should be irrelevant. But as long as you're arguing it on the basis of reason and evidence, which is to say, it is publicly inspectable, and somebody can come back at you and say, I am disputing these statistics of yours. I am disputing the logic of your argument. Right, so in other words, the dispute occurs at that level. And that is what's to be protected by academic freedom. So you can be arguing for genocide, frankly, but you have to argue it that way. Now, I don't think you get very far arguing it that way. I'd love to see the statistics. I'd love to see the arguments. Because typically, when genocide is persuasive, when it's presented as a purely emotive issue, right, where, you know, where, as it were, the strength of it comes when you're there listening to the guy speaking through a megaphone, right, with a mass rally out there. That's when it's most persuasive. It's not that persuasive when you see it in black and white, and you see numbers attached, and you see some detail. Now that's what I'm talking about here, because in a sense what you're protecting when you're protecting academic freedom is the right and the ability to be able to argue things that way, as opposed to just emotively out there. So academic freedom is not the same as free speech. Right? Free speech is a different kind of issue. And I think this is very important because, see, in a sense, one of the things I'm trying to sort of emphasize here is the distinctiveness of the academic's responsibility in the public intellectual sphere. You know, and what exactly does it mean when we speak truth to power? What it means is not that we pick up a megaphone and shout into the crowd like you're, you know, garden variety demagogue. That's not what it means. Right? It means that we actually mobilize the resources of logic and evidence in order to make a case, which means that we make ourselves vulnerable to others who can then question all this stuff. And see, because when you lay out logic and you lay out evidence, there are lots of places to disagree. But when you're just shouting through a megaphone in a mass rally where everybody's already heated up, right, it's pretty hard to disagree. Right? If you disagree, you better leave the scene fast, because you're not going to survive very long. Okay? So academic freedom, see, in the United States, there's this thing called the First Amendment to the Constitution. You know, the United States has a Bill of Rights, right, that was enacted shortly after the Constitution, which is something that's always being discussed in this country, whether we should have a Bill of Rights. The First Amendment, which is the first right in the Bill of Rights, is the freedom of speech. Okay? And now the freedom of speech is in fact defined in America as a kind of complex of freedoms. So in other words, it's not a general freedom just to speak your mind whenever you feel like it, but it's things like freedom of assembly. So if you want to discuss political matters, you can get together. Freedom of worship. You can decide to go to whatever church you want. Freedom of the press. If you want to start up your own newspaper to publicize things, you can do that too. Right? So it's freedom of speech. So there have been constitutional cases about what the limits of this thing is. And of course, there's always this case of shouting fire in the theater. You may have heard of this case. Right? When you want to talk about what the limits of free speech are, the idea, suppose you're in a crowded theater, right? And some you know, kind of mischievous person says, fire! And then, you say, you know, everybody stampedes and 12 people are killed and all the rest of it. And then the police come along and ask this guy, why did you say this? Oh, this is my freedom of speech. Hey, First Amendment. This is the 12 people got killed. Okay, now you see, typically the way this gets interpreted in the legal system of the United States, right, is to say that there are some limits to freedom of speech. But I think one of the things that this shows is that this interpretation of freedom of speech, you know, whereby, you know, shouting fire in a crowded theater counts as freedom of speech, right, is not thinking about speech as a medium for conveying ideas. It is thinking of speech as an action, right? As a motivation for action. In other words, as an action, just like you can't go around killing people because you feel like it, right? In a way, shouting fire in a crowded theater is kind of just one step removed from that. It is an action that you're performing, primarily. It is not a sort of intellectual activity, right? Which is what academic freedom is trying to protect. So, in terms of academic freedom, right, we can spend all day arguing about whether people should be allowed to shout fire in the crowded theater without being arrested. And I might make all of these arguments that end up persuading you that indeed they should be allowed. But that doesn't mean I should be arrested as a result of doing that. Now, if you then go out and do it, and 12 people are killed, then you get arrested. There's a difference. persuade you that, you know, it's okay to shout fire in a crowded theater. No, I don't know. You know, I don't know. You guys may be a little impressionable. But the point here is that there is a difference here, and it becomes important not to conflate the two. Because in the context of academic freedom, we may in fact be able to discuss in enormous detail lots of horrible things, right, that we would probably not want to be made part of, you know, normal political life necessarily, or something on which governments take action on. All right. It is very, you know, I think one area where this issue becomes very interesting is when you talk about things like the work of Peter Singer, for example. And I mentioned him in the intellectual book, and he's often discussed as the most important public philosopher in the world today. He's an Australian. He's the sort of the father of the animal rights movement. He wrote a book in 1975 called Animal Liberation. And he's written many, many books since then. He's a sort of world-class ethical theorist. He did his DPhil at Oxford. He's now at Princeton. He now has an endowed chair at Princeton University. Now, Peter Singer holds a whole cluster of views, which he argues for through many books, and has persuaded quite a lot of people, which might be called anti-human. Or let's put it this way, if they're not anti-human, they sort of blur the line between the value that we attribute to human life and the value that we attribute to other animal forms of life. Okay. Now, these arguments are largely informed not by sentimental things, but actually by scientific considerations based on developments in the biological sciences, where increasingly we are learning that animals have intelligence, they have sentience, that is to say they feel pleasure and pain and so forth. And on those bases, right, animals then are entitled to certain kinds of moral treatment, which he likes to talk about in terms of rights, because he believes the law ought to get involved in this. Okay? And that to a certain extent, human beings have been trampling on the rights of animals forever. And on the other side of the equation, he also believes that if we're talking about the value of life, we should not just be privileging human life, but we should be thinking in terms of the ability of the life form to live up to its genetically defined potential. So that is to say, in principle, right, the value of the pig and the value of the human are the same in principle, but in practice, a lot depends on the respect to which each individual can realize that potential. So in other words, you may have a completely healthy pig, that ought to be saved, but then you have some kind of genetically deficient human who's disabled in some way. Well, that gets a little priority. Right, because all life is created equal and is entitled to moral coverage. But what that means, you have to think of, you know, and to Singer's credit, okay, he thinks about what the detailed implications of this are and what implications this would have for things like, well, for example, our approach to biomedicine. You know about the animal rights activists who break into the labs at Oxford, at Huntington Labs, right? Well, in a sense, what are they doing? Peter Singer doesn't explicitly approve this, but he's often cited as the inspiration for a lot of this activity, right? You know, the idea here is that a lot of this biomedical stuff that goes on in these labs, which use animals as subjects, are in fact designed to artificially boost human life advantages, which, if they were left to their own devices, right, the humans would just die earlier, make room, as it were, for others. Right, they wouldn't be clogging up the planet. And they certainly wouldn't be clogging up all the funding to the detriment of animals who are then just used as means to come up with this research. So this is how the animal rights people see this. They're operating from a framework very similar to Singer. Now, Singer has written all these books and he argues all these cases. I think this man, you know, intellectually speaking, is the most dangerous man in the world. Much more dangerous than Saddam Hussein or the president of Iran or anything like that. He's very dangerous, right? Because I really do think he has the potential to really radically change the way we think about our place in the world. especially during a period where there's an enormous amount of disappointment and disillusionment with the sort of grand projects of human emancipation, right? Socialism, you know, even the any sort of, you know, left-wing project that was supposed to lead to equality and sort of the, you know, relief of poverty and, you know, all these things that, at least when I was a kid, was very much on the political agenda, right? An enormous amount of disappointment, disillusionment with this. And somebody like Peter Singer gives us another kind of agenda, which he's actually packaging as a left agenda as well, right? But basically downscales expectations with regard to what humans can be and do, but rather takes this more kind of leveled approach, kind of ecological balance approach, you might say. Okay? Now, the point here from the standpoint of academic freedom, right? Singer is not allowed to enter Austria. He cannot lecture in Austria, because these views that he holds are in fact very similar to Nazi views. See, you all think the Nazis are just about the Holocaust. No, forget about that. Right? I mean, Holocaust is the tail end of Nazism, but if you go back, and here I do think, I mean, those of you interested in Nazism, I really think to see the kind of why people were so seduced by it at the beginning. Because the problem with our understanding of Nazism in this context is we tend to understand it exclusively in terms of its outcome. Right? So we think about the Holocaust, with the 6 million Jews, all the rest of it, right? As if that was what it was entirely about, and as if that was what it was planned to be at the beginning. Okay? But if you look at what Nazism was about in the beginning, before they had any power, you go back to the 1920s, right? And you look at the first Nazi Party platform, it is very similar to what the British National Party says in terms of issues of migration, putting a strain on the welfare system in Germany after World War I, which is under dire economic straits. There's no talk about genocide or anything like that in there. There is talk about repatriation. And at that time, the Nazis were very much aligned with the Zionists. And, you know, the Zionists were the people who, you know, thought about Israel as a homeland to which Jews ought to be returning. And so they were actually on the same side of that issue back in 1920. Repatriation. Okay. Now, the thing about Nazism, and this kind of viewpoint, which was informed partially by Marxist politics, partially by Darwinian biology, and all this stuff is cited in the original stuff in the 1920s, attracted a lot of intellectuals. Right? They didn't necessarily like the people who were the political frontmen for this, because I think everybody pretty much figured that Hitler was a thug from the beginning, and that was one reason why they never thought he'd get to power. They thought he was too dumb. Right? He wasn't the kind of guy who could really front these kinds of ideas, which are really big ideas, right, about big things. Right? So they just thought, well, at some point he'll just kind of be marginalizing some real serious heavyweight will kind of come into play and carry these ideas forward. Okay. The point here, though, is, of course, what sounds kind of interesting and fascinating and something to talk about, you know, in a classroom, when it gets more political legs, right, when you start getting people in office who are now going to start enacting this stuff, right, then the whole ball game starts to play. It starts to change, right? It starts to become a different sort of game we're playing. And it's with that history in mind that Austria prevents Singer from coming in. Because they don't want him potentially influencing students who might then go into the political structure of Austria and reenact early 20th century.
Have enough other people to lecture.
That's true. This is a, you know, living, fire-breathing Austrian here. I mean, you know, so this is a very interesting point, okay? And it does raise a kind of issue here about where the line is between academic freedom and this kind of, you know, freedom of speech that may lead to action kind of thing. Okay? And so, you know, and so now you look at something like animal rights activists breaking into labs. Where does that fall in terms of this kind of distinction, you see? As you know now, some of these animal rights people, since they've been barred from being, you know, whatever, some kind of 1 mile radius around the labs and so forth, they're barred from being there, they've taken to threatening the lives of the scientists who happen to be working in the labs. Of course, that's a no-no, too, from a legal standpoint. But, of course, you know, that's harder to sort out. enormous amount of intimidation, right? But the point is, this is one way, if one takes these ideas very seriously and tries to apply them,
right?
Now, see, I'm of the opinion that basically there should be no constraint on these views of his and the way he discusses them in the academic forums, and I would say Peter Singer is a very responsible guy. He doesn't get involved in mass rallies or anything like that. He's a professor, okay? Writes his books, talks to academics. When he gets invited to Austria, it is to universities, okay? But there is a question, right, about the transition, the influence that goes from the academic forum, where we are allowed, and I think rightfully allowed, to discuss these issues, you know, with all the reason and evidence at our disposal. And what happens when this stuff then gets translated out into the political sphere? Okay? And in a sense, this is something that I think public intellectuals rarely find themselves in this, they rarely find themselves in the kind of position that Singer is in, where in a sense he can be so influential. And I think a lot has to do not with what he's saying specifically, but with a lot of these background issues that I've mentioned. With regard to the sort of disillusionment with a lot of the large-scale projects to relieve poverty and to emancipate people and so forth. I think that disillusionment, in a way, makes people kind of politically primed for thinking, well, maybe all of this, you know, all this concern about all this stuff about liberating people, maybe it's just a waste of time and we should just figure out a way of just living, as many of us living as well as possible on this planet together with everything else that lives here. Kind of second best solution, you might say, to survival. So there's a very serious kind of issue here. Now, you know, there is this kind of very difficult point here to sort out, and that is there some sense in which somebody like Singer may be right? Is there some kind of truth, some kind of fact of the matter, right, that could resolve this issue? Because you might say, well, God, we want our politics to be informed by what's true, what we know about the world. You know, we have the government always talking about things like evidence-based policy. You've heard that? That evidence-based medicine, evidence-based policy. Have people heard of this expression? No? Nobody's heard of this? Some of you have. Okay. Well, the point here is, right, the idea is that this is a way to make science appear relevant to public policy, but also to make the government look good, that it's actually, you know, doing things on the basis of the facts. Right? It's not just making stuff up as it goes along. And so there is this sense in which there is this, in a sense, truth isn't necessarily opposed to power, but power, in order to survive, needs to have truth on its side. Okay. Now, for the kinds of matters that somebody like Peter Singer raises about the ultimate value of human life, about the ultimate point of policy making, because Singer definitely sees himself in the ethics business, so in a sense this is something that should have some relevance to policy. Is there some way of telling whether he's right or wrong? Okay. I mean, because if you listen to Singer, what Singer is telling us is that if we keep on following advances in biological research and we get a clearer and clearer sense of the sort of mentalities of animals and humans and so forth, that we will come to realize that we're going to have to put in some kind of legal safeguards for animals. Because we will realize that they are, in fact, in their own way, feeling and experiencing things for which, in the human realm, we do have legal and ethical protections for it. And that's just, as it were, a result of treating like things like. Right? The kind of, you know, that there's a kind of equity principle, right? That if, you know, if you treat humans, you know, you treat people one way because they have these kinds of characteristics. Why don't you treat other things that also have those characteristics? Right? I mean, this is the way we got rid of racism. And in fact, Singer uses this term speciesism as a kind of modeled on racism. Because he thinks that, in fact, our politics our politics is speciesist. Just like it used to be racist. Okay, or maybe still is racist to a certain extent. And that we have to overcome that. And that we will overcome it the more informed we are. Because in fact, that's what happened with racism as well. Because one of the things that biological research showed, especially when we started getting a better understanding of genetics, was that in fact, you cannot so neatly segregate races in the way that was traditionally thought. Because basically in the past, right, the way races were distinguished was kind of like on the look of people, more or less. And you'd measure forehead and breadth of nose and, you know, stuff like that, right? And the assumption was that there would be some genetic difference that was systematic across people who looked in these systematically different ways. But that wasn't found, right? And in fact, people, if you look in the genome of the individuals that you would mark as being part of different races, there's a lot of mixture going on. So it's very difficult to sort of sort that out in any neat racial categories. So that helped to kill the concept of race, right? So that scientific information helped kill the concept of race from a legal and political standpoint. And so Singer is arguing that something similar is going to happen with species. The more we learn about animals, then we're going to see that, in fact, animals have a lot of the same traits we do. And in fact, this is happening. And that the problem in the past was that our experiments and our research wasn't clever enough to be able to detect these things in animals. Because it's quite clear animals can't talk, right? They can't speak English. You know, you can't train chimps to speak English. We got that figured out. Right? We know that. But that doesn't mean they don't know how to communicate. And that doesn't mean that what they're communicating isn't deep and meaningful. It's just we don't know what the hell they're saying. So we have to figure out how it is they're communicating. And this is what all this evolutionary psychology is about. And it's tricky business because you have to figure out where might the meaning be made, you might say, in the organism. What is it that they're doing? Because it might not necessarily be anything to do with their mouths. You know, when we think about how communication happens, right? Maybe some stuff with their feet, their body language. Okay? I mean, as you know, in human languages, right, some human languages, and especially some of the languages of Africa, right, in order to capture the meaning of what people are saying, you really can't just do it on the words. You have to look at rhythms, you have to look at lots of other things that are going on to get a complete picture of the meaning. And the problem is that very often, you know, we have a very kind of stereotyped way of thinking about how meaning is conveyed, namely, you know, words ideally made by the mouth that, you know, where letters correspond to vowels and consonants, right? But that's a very particularly Western way of looking at things. It doesn't even capture the way in which meaning is made in the full range of human languages. So imagine animals. How much more difficult the task is going to be. But gradually this is being managed. And so you're finding that animals are communicating all kinds of sophisticated things. So you can talk about different range of emotions that chimpanzees have, this kind of thing. And of course a lot of our political and legal issues in humans is very closely tied to the way in which we take humans to operate psychologically. Okay, what pain means in particular counts a lot. So Singer's saying as we learn more and more about this stuff, we're going to have to factor this into our legal system. Okay. So the question then becomes, at what point does this academic discussion, this sort of intellectually kind of rich discussion that's very interesting at many different levels, you know, at what point do we release this into the public sphere? Do we allow political parties to run with this? Okay. And should there be any restriction? And see, the public intellectual is always someone who's testing that kind of border. Okay. When I participated in the trial in intelligent design and evolution, one of the reasons why I think the defense counsel wanted my expert testimony was because of something that is very much taken for granted in the field that I was trained in. I was trained originally in history and philosophy of science. And you know, one of the things that we always say, you know, is that, in fact, the motivation for doing science historically has been largely theological. This is just true, okay? This is just a fact. This is the kind of thing that people who study my field will learn this. You can make what you will of it, but it's true. It's certainly true in the case of Sir Isaac Newton, and who's the greatest scientist who ever lived, and all the rest of them are pretty much like this. And the interesting thing about Darwin from that standpoint is Darwin is someone who starts off with a theological orientation, but by studying nature loses it. You know, he sort of becomes disillusioned. That's kind of the Darwin story. And that story has kind of anchored a way in which a lot of people sort of regard science today, namely that in a sense science is this kind of move from theology to this kind of more objective empirical reality. And Darwin's biography fits that very well. But if you're asking the general question about what has motivated science historically, it's been theological concerns, the idea that there's this unified worldview, that it has a rational structure, that our minds are particularly well adapted to be able to figure it out. Where does all that come from? That comes actually from the Bible. And there's no boat. People didn't really hide that very much. If you go to Newton's library, most of his stuff is religious. Okay? Now, it's one thing to say this in a seminar in the history of science or the philosophy of science or whatever. It's another thing to say this in a courtroom when you're trying to decide what should be taught in science class. And then all of a sudden the stakes are different, the point of the statement is different, and you see, you then get into this kind of public intellectual problem, right? Namely, what is very taken for granted and very obvious, you know, to people who actually work in the field and have that kind of intellectual grasp of what's going on, when you put it into a public discussion, right, where you've got a lot of different other kinds of players who come in with different sorts of views about the matter already, you know, like if you have a sort of stereotype view of religious people as just Bible-beating fundamentalists, right, who believe that the world was created in 6 days, right, and you've got scientists who think that the only way they can preserve their work is by keeping all that away from the labs, okay, then you're going to have an enormous amount of conflict and controversy. But so the point is, what might seem very uncontroversial from an academic standpoint becomes very controversial when it's out in the public sphere, and maybe even inflammatory. Right? Because one implication of this kind of view about the way the history of science is developed is that the attempt to separate church and state, the religion-science distinction in the U.S. Constitution, right, may be misdirected. And that's a real serious problem from a political standpoint, because that opens the door to all kinds of mischief. Okay? So, I mean, and I should tell you, I've been widely condemned by people in my own field for having participated in this trial. In fact, the strongest objections have come from those people. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you might wonder why exactly. It's not because anything I said was false, but in a sense, it's not meant for public consumption. Right? So in other words, there is this idea that academic freedom, in order to be really operative, has to kind of draw a line around itself, or in a sense, the kinds of things that I tell you in a classroom or in a seminar or write about in peer-reviewed publications, right, in a way stay here. They don't then just get unleashed out into the world willy-nilly to be used by however people use them. Right, and the same thing, you know, in a more drastic way, the same sort of thing with Peter Singer. Peter Singer does not address rallies, he's addressing classrooms just like this one. And he's saying the things he's saying, and people are giving him arguments back and forth. He's publishing his books, his articles. But then when you release him to the general public, and people start to play around with the ideas and take them directions, then all sorts of new issues get started. Okay? And so this is the sort of tricky part, in a way, about academic freedom, is there a line to be drawn? You know, in other words, it's one thing to protect academics being free to argue out cases in the classroom, even very, very extreme cases. But then the question is, can we allow these skills out in public view? So in other words, making the same arguments that I'm making to you in the classroom, but now instead making them in front of national television with 20 million people watching. Does that make a difference? Does that require a restriction on academic freedom? And here, philosophers, as opposed to intellectuals, tend to believe that there are natural restraints. That in a sense, right, people, ordinary people, are not necessarily prepared mentally to deal with these issues. That there needs to be some kind of mediation. And this is an idea that goes all the way back to Plato, okay, Plato's Republic, that basically if you want truth to remain truth and to be pure, it's got to be cultivated by people whose minds are able to deal with what often is the strikingly radical difference between what is true or likely to be true and what is acceptable, conventional, palatable, whatever. That you need, that you have to, otherwise truth will not be protected. Now this argument has been made again and again throughout history as a reason why public intellectual life is impossible, right? In other words, academic freedom is fine as long as it's in a classroom, but the academics can't go public. And in the public sphere, what do you have? You have politicians who are double-talking and telling lies all the time, but at least they're keeping order. They're saying what's convenient to get by, to get through the next election, to keep people pacified. And so you've got these two realms next to each other. This is the sort of thing the Catholic Church used to call a double truth doctrine. Right? Namely, there's a sort of truth for the masses, which is to keep them pacified so that they don't, they don't start imagining things that they can't do anything about. Right? And then there is the truth for the people who are the scholars, the true intellectuals, the people who are in the academies and things like that. And these two things are radically separate. And there's no public intellectual life if you believe that. Because there's just these two realms. There's politics and there's science. Okay? And so that's the kind of issue that people would raise. So like, Peter Singer, don't write newspaper articles. And Peter Singer writes a lot of newspaper articles, it turns out. Does a lot of public speaking. He's making his arguments pretty much the same way he makes them in his books, but he's making them to this wider audience. And that's a no-no, according to this double truth doctrine. Okay? So this is one clear place where intellectuals and philosophers are really quite different from each other. Because intellectuals are quite happy with what Peter Singer's doing. Basically, promoting in this, intellectually sophisticated fashion, these kinds of views, arguing them out in all kinds of forms, not just a classroom, but newspapers, public addresses, whatever. Philosophers, on the other hand, and philosophers tend to be very critical of Singer precisely on this point, because philosophers will say, well, look, Peter Singer, you're this distinguished, sophisticated professor. You tell all this stuff you're saying about animals to impressionable people who aren't schooled the way you are, and they might not see the holes in your argument. Right? They might, they might say, wow, man, yeah, let's break into those labs. Okay? So that's where the philosophers come back at him. And this kind of argument was used, for example, in the 1960s. There was a very famous book called The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom. And this was a book by a professor who's in fact the American translator of Plato's Republic, this guy, Bloom. And what he argued was that the reason why you got all this student unrest in the 1960s was because people were being taught about Marx, Freud, Nietzsche, in large numbers. Universities were getting really, that's the period when they started to get really big. And the people who were coming into the universities at this point were no longer the kind of well-trained, elite type of people who already had a sufficient intellectual background to be able to put Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche in their place. So they weren't, in other words, these people who came from a much wider spectrum of society in the 1960s, right, couldn't answer back. So they were just overwhelmed by all of the nihilism that they were receiving by studying Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud, and that just led them to go berserk. And then there were riots and counterculture and all of the decline and decay that Bloom believes we live through today. He's a conservative. Okay, but this is very much like Plato would think, right? He's a translator of Plato and he thinks like Plato, right? This is what Plato would say about taking all these radical views and teaching them to people who aren't mentally prepared for it, and then they go out and start to enact them. They have no way of resisting them. And that's very much a philosopher's view toward this kind of radical stuff. Truth is this elite thing for the prepared mind, and everybody else has to be told what Plato called noble lies. Okay? So that's the first point. That's where we'll stop here today, because that gives you a sense of where the public intellectual and the philosopher sort of lock horns in these kinds of matters, and I'll continue this discussion next week. Okay? I had only, you know, it was only halfway through the Singer example I realized that you were Austrian.
Well,
but you're what a reactionary country.